From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, National Book Award-winning writer Sigrid Nunez talks about her new novel, What Are You Going Through? It's about the fear that climate change, a pandemic, and far-right regimes will spell the end of civilization and the death of the planet. The novel is also about facing mortality as an individual and the relationship between a writer dying of cancer and the friend she asked to stay with her. Later, Lord Schwartz reviews a 2-CD set of excerpts of live performances by Leontine Price, the first black soprano to have a major career at the Metropolitan Opera. And John Powers reviews the Netflix series The Queen's Gambit about a brilliant young woman who crashes the traditionally male world of chess. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Sigrid Nunez, has written a new novel that's about facing the possible death of our planet from climate change while also dealing with our mortality as individuals. She wrote it before the pandemic, but one of her previous novels was set during a flu pandemic that results in anarchy. The narrator of the new novel is a woman whose ex is a well-known professor and author who's been writing and giving talks about how climate change, bioterrorism, cyberterrorism, the threat of a pandemic, far-right regimes, and corporate power are a threat to life, liberty, and civilization. He angers audiences by suggesting maybe it's time to stop having children. On a more personal level, the narrator's old friend, a famous writer and intellectual, is dying of cancer and wants her final days to be spent in solitude, but wants a friend to be with her. She asks the narrator to be that person. Part of the dying woman's plan is to end her life with a euthanasia drug when she feels the time is right. In a New York Times book review, Janice Lee wrote, "In What Are You Going Through?, Nunez tells the simplest of stories about a woman accompanying a terminally ill friend through her last months, and expands it into an exploration of the largest themes, nothing less than the realities of living and dying in this world, and how we feel about both." Sigrid Nunez received a 2018 National Book Award for her previous novel, The Friend. She's taught at Princeton and Columbia and currently teaches at Boston University. Sigrid Nunez, welcome back to Fresh Air. I love the new novel. Thank you for writing it. So I want you to do a short reading from the book, and this is when the friend who's dying from cancer tells the narrator that she wants to go somewhere else to die, and the narrator thinks her friend is just asking her to help her find a nice spot to go to. But her friend describes what she really means, what she really wants. Would you read that excerpt for us?
Yes, sure. "What I really want is to find some quiet place. It doesn't have to be far away. In fact, it shouldn't be too far. And it doesn't have to be anything particularly special, just somewhere I can be peaceful and do the last things that need to be done. And think my last thoughts," she adds as her breath runs out, "whatever they might be." I relax my grip on my glass. So all she's asking is for me to help her find this ideal place. I ask her whether she's sure about wanting to be in a strange place rather than home. "I think it will make it easier," she says, "so long as it's a comfortable, safe, attractive place. I've done a lot of my best work, my best thinking, away from home, on visiting fellowships, for example, on meditation retreats, even in hotels. I think it will be easier to prepare, to focus on letting go, if I'm someplace where I won't be surrounded by intimate, familiar things, all those reminders of attachments and so on. Of course, I could be wrong," she says, "and this could all turn out to be some kind of fantasy. But I've thought a lot about it, and it feels right to me. Am I making any sense?" "I think so," I say. "And you need my help finding a place or helping you get settled in?" "No," she says, "I can do that myself. I've already started looking." She lays one palm flat on the table and presses her other hand on top of it to quell or hide the tremor. "What I need is someone to be there with me," she says. "I'll want some solitude, of course. It's what I'm used to, after all, what I've always craved. Dying hasn't changed that. But I can't be completely alone. I mean, this is a new adventure. Who can say what it will really be like? What if something goes wrong? What if everything goes wrong? I need to know there's someone in the next room."
People think of a good death as a death surrounded by family and friends, being lifted up by them, being spoken to, have your hand held, being sung to. The idea of needing solitude, a place that would be peaceful, but not be surrounded by things you're attached to or by people you're attached to, but just by one person who's there in case, a person who's a friend, but not family. You wrote that. Did you understand the sentiment that you were writing?
I did. I believe I did. I felt that this was a way that a certain kind of person would feel. You know, this character, she has a daughter, but she's estranged from her daughter, and she's single at the moment, and she has asked her closest friends if they will be with her at the end. And they've said no because they do not want to be there if she's going to take her own life, much as they don't want to hurt her to suffer, much as they understand why she wants to choose her own moment to die. They know they would not be able to do that. So she calls on this old friend who, at least at the moment, isn't very, very close to her. They were close when they were younger, and they've always stayed in touch. And there's a thing about her, about this character, is that she's, in a sense, she wants things to be as orderly as possible, as peaceful as possible, and also to be as little trouble to anyone as possible. That's just in her nature. But I think that if she were dying without having the idea that she was going to use these drugs, then maybe she would have other people around her and holding her hand and so on. But there is that idea that if you're going to take your own life, not everybody is going to want to be there and is going to allow that to happen.
So part of your book, the part of it that's about how the world is on the brink, you know, possibly the end of civilization, the end of the planet because of cyberterrorism and bioterrorism and climate change, global warming, a pandemic. You actually wrote the book before the pandemic.
Yes.
And it's published just as numbers are really going up again. And you have an earlier novel about an influenza pandemic. What made you want to write about that before we were actually in the middle of one? I mean, it's not the flu, but it is a pandemic.
There were a couple of things. One, I am someone who always thought, from what I knew, that sometime in my lifetime, there would be another great flu.
You always knew that?
I always knew that. I mean, I knew that because I was aware of the science that said that it's not a question of if, but when. I mean, that's been well known. And, you know, I would come upon things that were, you know, that were said by Dr. Fauci about this well before the new pandemic, the pandemic that we're living through. And I knew that Mary McCarthy had lost both of her parents in that flu. And I remember when I learned that as a younger person, I thought that was so terrible. But then I learned that there were a lot of orphans came out of the great flu. And then William Maxwell, of course, lost his mother when he was just a little boy and never got over it. And everything he's ever written, you know, has that as part of the emotions of the book. So I, you know, it was really that. I mean, I wanted to have a certain amount of science in it. I wanted to, you know, to say what would happen in the world if there were such a flu. So there's that. But I wasn't trying to write like an apocalyptic story or a dystopian novel. I really wanted to focus on a boy who loses both parents in the flu, who becomes very sick himself, and who is in a place where, you know, where things are very chaotic, where things are really falling apart.
I want to quote something that you write in the book, and I feel the same way. You write, "It amazes me now to think back to when I was an adolescent and to remember how little attention my friends and I paid to one another's parents and grandparents. What could they possibly have to say, these ordinary people, most of whom, if they weren't housewives or retirees, went to work every day at jobs we couldn't imagine being the least bit interesting? It was only later it occurred to me that these were people who'd lived through some of the most dramatic events of the century. They had come of age during periods of upheaval, had endured all types of hardships, had escaped harrowing conditions in foreign countries or in the Deep South, become homeless during the Depression, fought in world wars, been held captive in prisons, survived death camps." I mean, that amazes me too, especially like my grandparents. They were immigrants from shtetls in Eastern Europe and Russia, and I displayed a minimal amount of curiosity. Why do you think that is, that you and I and probably a lot of other people when they were younger or when they're young now aren't really interested in what their parents or grandparents or other, you know, older people in their lives experienced?
I think it's pretty much universal. I think it's about being a young person, because I cannot think of anybody for whom this wouldn't be true. I mean, you know, when you think back just not just about yourself, but think about your girlfriends or your little circle in high school and junior high school. No one among your friends was not like that. What you were interested in exclusively was what your best friends were doing, what they had done on Saturday night, what kind of hair they were wearing, what they were reading, what they'd seen on TV, whatever it might be. That was fascinating, you know, and you could talk forever. But what their parents had been through, what your friends' parents might have to talk about, or their grandparents, you know, you would have died if you were sitting in their kitchen, you know, and they had started in about some experience from their past. You would have tried to be polite, but you would not have been really interested, I believe. And I'm not really sure why that is, but it is a question of feeling, you know, that it's just not your world. It's that generation gap, I guess. And in fact, if you knew someone, a very young person, who was the opposite of that, that would have been the class weirdo. That would have been a person like, well, how strange that, why does he do that? He always wants to talk to these old people about what they did in the war. And, you know, and I guess it also comes from the idea that for young people, older people are boring.
Let me reintroduce you here. If you're just joining us, my guest is Sigrid Nunez. Her new novel is called What Are You Going Through? We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my interview with Sigrid Nunez. Her new novel, What Are You Going Through?, is told from the point of view of a nameless narrator, a woman who's asked by her old friend to live with her in her final days or weeks as she dies from cancer. Nunez's previous novel, The Friend, won a 2018 National Book Award. Your new novel, What Are You Going Through?, starts with a quote from Simone Weil. And the quote is, the love of our neighbor in all its fullness simply means being able to say to him, what are you going through? But the original French has a slightly different meaning. Tell us what the original French says. She was French and wrote in French. And then tell us why that quote is so meaningful to you.
Well, in French, she wrote, quel est ton tourment? Which would literally translate as, what is your torment? But of course, that doesn't, it makes sense in English. I mean, you know, that it, you don't translate things literally. And so in English, at least in the translations that I've seen, that has become, what are you going through? And in fact, that is what we say to people. I'm really sorry about what you're going through. So I guess I can't remember when I first read this quote, but it seemed to me to be, you know, absolutely true and meaningful. And since this book was going to be about people talking to the narrator and the narrator listening to their stories, which were often sad stories or stories of trouble of different degrees, it just seemed to me, you know, totally apt to have that title and to use this quote as an epigraph.
You quote Henry James, the writer, as having said, there are two kinds of people in the world, those who upon seeing someone else suffering think, that could happen to me, and those who think, that will never happen to me. The first kind of people help us endure. The second kind make life hell. Your thoughts about that?
Well, I lied, actually. Henry James didn't say that. What I have in the text is that the narrator's been thinking about something else that Henry James had said, and then she thinks what you just read. And so the narrator says, someone, maybe or maybe Henry James, or maybe not Henry James, said, and then your quote, what you quoted. I think whoever said it, I think it's absolutely true. And it goes back to the Simone Weil quote, because her idea about loving your neighbor in the way that she's talking about, enough to say, what are you going through meaningfully, and then want to listen, that depends on your seeing, and this is in her essay where that quote comes from, that depends on your seeing that person, that afflicted person, as an individual and identifying with that person, you know, in a full way. So I think it's absolutely true. I mean, and that kind of person who automatically dismisses other people's suffering with that, you know, well, that won't happen to me, so why should I be concerned? Yeah, I find that kind of person, you know, really, really, really quite terrifying.
I want to ask you a little bit about your relationship with the writer, essayist, intellectual Susan Sontag, who was really, as much as somebody can be a celebrity intellectual, she was in the 70s and 80s and 90s, in the 60s too, should we say? And you knew her, you worked with her, and then you also were a couple with her son, David Reif, for a while. How did you first meet, and what impact did she have on you as a writer?
Well, I met Susan Sontag because I was an editorial assistant at the New York Review of Books, and that was in between college and grad school. And so I met her in passing there. But then after I graduated from grad school, she had her first bout of cancer. And we lived very close to each other, you know, just on 106th Street. She was at Riverside Drive. I was, you know, just a few buildings away. And she wanted, she'd had her surgery, and she wanted some help, because she had this great big pile of correspondence that had, you know, built up while she was in the hospital. She just wanted somebody to sit there and type while she dictated. And she asked her friends at the New York Review of Books if they could recommend somebody, and since I lived so nearby, they said, well, why don't you do this? And I did. I mean, we only did it for about 12 hours on two or three occasions. But during that time, I met her son, David Reif. And yeah, we ended up a couple. And at that time, David was living in the same apartment as his mother, and also in Princeton, where he was in school. He was dividing his time between those two places. I ended up moving into the apartment with them at 340 Riverside Drive. And so we were living together as a little family. Now, her impact on me as a writer was enormous. I mean, enormous. Something that I, to this day, am extremely grateful for. And I guess the main thing is I've read her work and had read some of it before I met her. And of course, that was an influence, because a lot of it is so important. But to meet her and to have her in my life, it was a different thing, because she was somebody who made me feel like, even at that point in my life where I'd never published anything, where I didn't have any idea what I was doing really, that, you know, that it was a perfectly good idea and a right thing to do, and even a noble thing to do, to take myself and my work, you know, totally seriously, and to think about making any kind of sacrifice I might have to for it. And that everything matters, and that you must read everything, and just, you know, that kind of attitude. And she just introduced me to so many different books and movies and just everything, because she was a great sharer, and she liked to be a big influence on anyone who was in her circle. Or, you know, if she'd read something and thought it was great, she wasn't happy until she'd gotten all these other people also to read it. Yeah, so the way I write, the way I think, my attitude towards what it's like to be a writer, all of this was influenced heavily by the time that I knew Susan Sontag.
Was it important to you to have a mentor like that who was a woman? Because there weren't as many well-known women writers at the time as there are now.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that was also a really important part of it, because that was, you know, because the idea was part of her mentoring was also, don't let people influence you in such a way to make you think that because you're a woman, you can't do this or that, or you're a woman writer, in other words, a lesser writer, you know, and don't be afraid to not look feminine. All these things were very important to her.
Let me reintroduce you here. If you're just joining us, my guest is Sigrid Nunez. Her new novel is called What Are You Going Through? We'll talk more after a break. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Our Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance with the Name Your Price tool, offering a range of coverage and price options to choose from. Now that's Progressive. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, working to harness the power of research to make a difference in the lives of children, teens, and young adults for more than 80 years. Learn more at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to my interview with writer Sigrid Nunez. Her new novel, What Are You Going Through?, is about a woman whose friend is dying of cancer. The friend wants solitude in her final days, but wants the narrator of the story to live with her during that time, in case everything goes wrong. Part of the dying woman's plan is to end her life with pills when she feels it's time. The narrator's ex is a famous writer who's been writing about how the threats of climate change, a pandemic, terrorism, corporate power, far-right regimes, and more are leading to the end of civilization. Nunez's previous novel, The Friend, won a 2018 National Book Award. When we left off, we were talking about her mentor and friend, Susan Sontag.
You had said in an interview that you figured out you didn't want to be famous by watching how fame had affected Susan Sontag's life and the responsibilities that came with fame. So what were some of the things that you saw that convinced you you didn't really want to be as famous as she was?
Well, I don't think I ever expected to be anywhere as famous as she was, but what gave me pause was how much of a distraction fame can be. And what I saw, she handled fame very well. I mean, the thing is that she was able to do a lot, and she always wanted to do a lot. And I'm someone who always only wanted to do one thing well. And I have this great need for solitude, and she was the exact opposite. There's nothing that she hated more than being alone. There were so many demands and so many distractions, and she didn't have any trouble keeping up. But I looked at that and I thought, well, if this is the writer's life, that's not going to work for me. I could never handle anything like that. But of course, I knew that there was a whole other kind of writer's life, obscurity. You could be left quite alone. And, you know, and I knew other writers who, even though they were publishing and they were successful, they didn't have anything like her celebrity, and therefore they also didn't have the kinds of demands. And plus, the publicness of it, when you're as famous as she is, you attract a certain amount of negative attention as well. She was able to handle that well also. But if I tried to put myself in that position, I thought it was actually quite intimidating and undesirable.
Your parents, were they both immigrants?
Yes, they were.
And your father was part Chinese, part Panamanian?
Yes, and my mother was German.
So what was it like for you having parents from different cultures?
You know, it was a strange marriage, and strange for the three of us, the three children in that household, because very often with an immigrant family, the immigrant parents are both from the same country and culture and speak the same language. And in my case, you know, they were from different places, and they didn't really have, what they had in common as a common language was English, which my father never really learned English that well. And my mother, though she kept a heavy accent all her life, her English actually was quite good. But they were really quite at odds with each other's culture. There was that divide, and, you know, my father really didn't participate much in family life, largely because my mother, she wanted us to be German-American children, or German children, really. I mean, she was very nostalgic, she's very, very homesick, and, you know, she saw us as her children, you know, as opposed to their children. She made all the decisions, and, you know, and my father was really very, very outside. So we, as growing up, we didn't really have any access to that part of our heritage. He kept it very secret in a way. He didn't share. He did not share. And my mother, as I say, was the dominant one, and created a German household.
Was it confusing to you?
Yeah, it was. It was very confusing. It was very confusing. And in fact, many people, their first book is autobiographical, many writers. And I've always thought that that's because the writer has to get certain things taken care of before they can move on to other kinds of stories. And for me, I really felt that I had to write that first book. I had to get that down. I had to think hard about all that before I could go on with life and with the writing life.
Did your father grow up in China or Panama?
My father was born in Panama, but he spent his boyhood, most of his boyhood, in Shanghai. And then he came to the United States and ended up living in Brooklyn. But there's so much about my father's life that I don't know, and that has never really been clear to me. It's always been very sketchy, and that's a big part of what I write about in that first book.
So why did your mother leave Germany and come to the U.S., since she was so attached to Germany and wanted you to be raised like in a German way?
This was after World War II. This was after Germany's defeat. My father was in the army, and he was stationed in southern Germany, and that's where he met my mother. And you know, as I say, he was from New York. He was from Chinatown, New York, and they got married. She was a German war bride. They ended up first in the Fort Greene housing project in Brooklyn.
My impression is that they weren't like terribly close. Did your mother resent having come to the U.S. and regret the marriage?
She did. She never got over her homesickness, and she never felt really at home in the United States, at least during the time that we were growing up. I mean, she lived to her mid-90s, and so, you know, in much later life, I think she was reconciled to her new country. But she always used the word home about Germany her entire life. She would say, well, you know, at home. And, you know, that she did not mean the place that we were all living in. So it was very deep, that feeling of having been uprooted. And she did have many regrets about her marriage and her situation. And, you know, she was definitely not happy with her lot.
I want to get back to your new novel, What Are You Going Through?, in which the narrator is asked by an old friend to be with her while the friend is experiencing her last, you know, weeks dying of cancer. And, you know, the friend who's dying has a daughter, but they are not close. They fight all the time. And the friend who's dying doesn't even want her daughter around. The narrator, who is asked to spend time with the friend who's dying, is not married and has no children. You're not married and you have no children. Have you thought a lot about the future? You know, like when you're dying, like people who are parents, they want their children by their bedside, their spouse, if they have one, by their bedside. Have you thought about, like, who will be there for me when I'm dying? Because I know that that's a question a lot of people who don't have children, whether they couldn't and or whether they decided not to. It's a question they often ask themselves, and also people who are single, whether they lost their spouse or never had a spouse.
Well, it's something that I have thought about, and this is where, you know, I do have, you know, I have family. I don't have children, and I am single, but I, you know, I'm close to my nephew and his wife and their children. You know, this is where you think about your friends. I mean, I think about it, but I don't worry about it. I figure I have people in my life that I feel I will be able to count on. But I think it's very important, you know, what you're saying. And I think one of the things with the pandemic that is something that people didn't think about was that these people who were not able to have their loved ones with them at the end. I mean, it's just been one of the great brutalities of this situation. So now it feels even more real in a way, that idea that you could be completely alone. And there are many reasons why we want this pandemic to come to an end, but that is one of the main ones, because I think that is one of the most terrible consequences of the pandemic.
Sigrid Nunez, a pleasure to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Sigrid Nunez is the author of the new novel, What Are You Going Through? After we take a short break, Lord Schwartz will review a new double CD collecting excerpts of live performances by Leontine Price, the first Black soprano to have a major career at the Metropolitan Opera. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Total Wine & More, where in-store teams can recommend a bottle of wine, spirit, or beer for any occasion. Shoppers can explore more than 8,000 wines, 2,500 beers, and 3,000 spirits. More at TotalWine.com. And from LifeLock, reminding consumers that they could miss certain threats by only monitoring their credit, like their info for sale on the dark web. Learn more at lifelock.com/NPR.
This is Fresh Air. Soprano Leontine Price, who's now 93 years old, has been one of America's most beloved opera divas. She was the first African-American soprano to have a major career at the Metropolitan Opera. Critics and fans agreed that she had one of the most beautiful singing voices they'd ever heard. The Met has just released a 2-CD set of excerpts from her live performances there. Our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, has a review.
That was the sublime voice of soprano Leontine Price in Verdi's Il Trovatore, recorded in February 1961, just a few days after her Metropolitan Opera debut. In those days, when I was still a student in New York, a friend and I would meet in the city to take in a movie or a Broadway play. One day, later that year, we were passing the old Metropolitan Opera House on 39th Street. The opera was Verdi's Aida, with Leontine Price singing the title role. It was sold out, but there was a long line of people waiting for standing room tickets. We got in, and it was one of the great musical experiences of my life. We were standing so far to the side, we couldn't see half the stage. But for Aida's big arias, Price would come down to the footlights to be in full view of the nearly 4,000 people in the audience, wherever they were sitting or standing. She was in ravishing voice, effortlessly pouring out Verdi's soaring melodies with exquisite high notes and real trills. She wasn't an especially nuanced actress, but her emotions were always honest, especially in a role like Aida, who is an Ethiopian princess who becomes an Egyptian slave. Price was the first Black artist to have a major career at the Metropolitan Opera. In her first Met season, she sang leading roles in 5 different operas. When the Met moved to Lincoln Center in 1966, the new Met opened not with an old war horse, but with a new American opera composed especially for her, Samuel Barber's Antony and Cleopatra, with Price as Cleopatra. Unfortunately, it wasn't the landmark work everyone had hoped for. After that first season, the Met never scheduled it again. Here's Price in Cleopatra's death scene. "Give me my robe, put on my crown, I have immortal longings in me." The words are by Shakespeare. I really miss live performances. No reproduction can match the sound of a living singer right there in the theater with you. But this new double CD set of live Leontine Price performances is a treasure. She sings Puccini's Tosca, one of her most popular roles, though not one of my own favorites, along with some Mozart, and the composer her voice was most ideally suited for, Verdi. This set includes excerpts from Verdi's Requiem and 5 Verdi operas, with, of course, Aida. We even get to hear the applause. The very last selection on this album is Aida's best-known aria, O Patria Mia, from Price's very last performance at the Met in 1985, after singing there for nearly 20 years. I'd like you to hear a part of that same performance that's included in a fascinating documentary called The Opera House, which is about the creation of Lincoln Center, and pulls no punches about the cost of the whole project, not only in dollars, but also to the people who were forced to lose their homes when the city demolished their neighborhood. At the beginning of the film, the nearly 90-year-old Leontine Price talks about the home she found at the Met, and there's a video clip from that farewell performance. In the aria, she repeats the words, "Oh, my homeland, I'll never see you again," each time with more longing, more desolation, and more beauty.
My beauty rivet rose
is the temple of opera, where I sang my last performance. The only person had the joie de chant. I mean, my colleagues, you know, we just love singing. That's the first thing on your list, is to sing and enjoy, because that is what makes the audience love the whole human experience.
Price's performance of that aria from Aida is a thrilling example of why people who love opera love it so much. One of the ideas underlying all grand opera is the possibility that great beauty can triumph over great loss. Leontine Price was a master of conveying that idea.
Lloyd Schwartz is the Frederick S. Troy Professor of English Emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Boston and the Poet Laureate of the City of Somerville, Massachusetts. He reviewed a 2-CD set called Leontine Price at the Met. After we take a short break, John Powers will review the new Netflix series, The Queen's Gambit. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. The new Netflix series, The Queen's Gambit, which drops this Friday, is about a brilliant young woman who crashes the traditionally male world of chess. Our critic at large, John Power, says that the series offers the kind of heroine we seldom see.
Good novels, the saying goes, make bad movies. But you wouldn't know that from Walter Tevis, a skillful novelist whose books have been turned into memorable movies. The Hustler, The Man Who Fell to Earth, The Color of Money. That's why, ever since Tevis published The Queen's Gambit in 1983, fans have been waiting for someone to adapt this addictive page-turner about a troubled female chess prodigy. The Queen's Gambit finally arrives on screen this week as a 7-part miniseries from Netflix. It was made by Scott Frank, a crack adapter of novels. He scripted Out of Sight and Get Shorty, among others, and the writer-director of the Western Godless. Although I wish it was directed with a bit more flair, its story is a good one. The action begins in early 1960s Kentucky, when 8-year-old orphan Beth Harmon, that's Isla Johnston, is put into an institution that keeps the girls in line with tranquilizers. A quiet loner, Beth has two unlikely allies, Jolene, a shrewd African-American orphan played by Moses Ingram, and the janitor, played by the reliably superb Bill Camp. He teaches her to play chess, and though he starts off gruff, he's soon awed by the gifts of a child who can play out entire chess games by watching them unfold on the flickering shadows of the ceiling. When Beth is 13, and now played by Anya Taylor-Joy, she's adopted by the Wheatleys, an unhappily married Lexington couple. Her home life is dominated by her new mom, played by film director Mariel Heller, a thwarted musician and alcoholic who largely ignores her. Then Beth begins winning tournaments and prize money. Soon, this wunderkind is jetting from Vegas to Mexico City to Paris to Moscow, self-destructively cooling her overheated psyche with booze and pills. Her whole life keeps building to a final showdown with the world champion, a daunting Russian who seems Soviet manufactured, while Beth's a true American, moody, improvisational, solitary. You see her aloneness and innocence in this early scene when 13-year-old Beth hands over $5 to enter the Kentucky State Championship and is met with condescension.
Do you have a clock?
No.
We have a clock sharing system. If your opponent doesn't have one, come back to the desk and we'll loan you one. Play starts in 20 minutes. What's your rating?
I don't have a rating.
Have you ever played in a tournament before?
No.
Are you sure you want to do this?
I'm sure.
We don't have a women's section. I'll put you in beginners.
I'm not a beginner.
Doesn't matter. If you're an unrated player, you go in beginners with the people under 1600.
What's the prize for beginners?
20.
What about the other section?
First prize in the open is 100.
Is it against any rule for me to be in the open?
Not exactly.
Put me in the open.
There are 3 guys in there with ratings over 1800. And Beltic may show up. They will eat you alive.
I don't think it's a spoiler to say that Beth is smarter than those guys. Now, Tevis tells this story with a bristling economy that mirrors Beth's attacking chess style. To make it work on screen, you must either make a stylistically compressed art movie or play everything out. Frank does the latter, and while I kept wishing the series moved faster, 7 episodes is too many, I admire how he pulls off the trick of portraying chess, the most internal of games, by cooking up ever-changing styles to make each match feel different and fresh. Frank enriches Beth's relationship to her mom, transcending stage mother cliches to help us see how Mrs. Wheatley is just one of the millions of smart, frustrated women back in the pre-feminist days. And he wins nifty turns from the men in Beth's life, most notably Benny, the cocky young U.S. champion who carries himself like a gunslinger. He's played by the sensational Thomas Brody Sangster. With her wide-set eyes and mask-like features, Taylor-Joy is one of those actors, like Keanu Reeves, who was born to play otherworldly characters. Here, she's a double outsider. For starters, she's a female chess mastermind, which makes her a unicorn in a subculture dominated by strutting male egos. Beth hates being called a great woman chess player. She wants to be the best player, period. She's also a flat-out genius. This makes her a rarity in our storytelling. It's not that there aren't as many intelligent women as men. Heck, Oprah's as much a genius as Steve Jobs ever was. But our ideas about genius are gendered, or more bluntly, sexist. Even as our pop culture is overstuffed with stories about men celebrated as geniuses, be it Van Gogh, Ray Charles, or Stephen Hawking, plus fictional dudes like Sherlock Holmes, there are almost none about women. You have Virginia Woolf in The Hours. Katherine Johnson in Hidden Figures, maybe the girl with the dragon tattoo. We can add Beth Harmon to this short list. Although her story doesn't escape the usual trajectory of on-screen geniuses, to triumph over the psychic costs imposed by one's great gifts, The Queen's Gambit does offer something exciting. What makes the heroine isn't that she's lovely, charming, or likable. It's that whatever room she walks into, she's always the most brilliant person there.
John Powers reviewed The Queen's Gambit, the new Netflix series that drops Friday. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, my guest will be Nina Totenberg, NPR's longtime legal affairs correspondent. We'll talk about the Amy Coney Barrett confirmation hearings, how Trump has transformed the Supreme Court and the federal appeals courts, Nina's longtime friendship with RBG, and being a founding mother of NPR. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Chaloner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our associate producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Hulu, presenting the original documentary, I Am Greta, a portrait of teenage climate activist Greta Thunberg, exclusively in theaters Friday and streaming on Hulu November 13th. And from Capital One, offering reimagined banking to fit people's lives, like Capital One Cafes, where customers can grab coffee, bank, and chat with an ambassador. What's in your wallet? More at CapitalOne.com.